In the episode you're about to listen to, I was recording in John Gagne's gallery. And in this situation, there's a lot of room echo because it's a large open room. Apologies if that bothers anyone, but the content of the episode is still solid, and I just want you to enjoy the episode being armed with that knowledge. Enjoy. I think I may just end up stealing how you introduce yourself in the other episode and just put it in this one, but I might not as well. Anyways, the point of it is, this is Can't Sell This. So if you're listening to this and haven't listened to the John Gagne episode on Dismissed, my other podcast, I highly recommend you hit pause and then pop over to Dismissed.
Right.
Which I think I said in the beginning of the first one.
You did.
And if you're coming here from Dismissed, buckle up.
Nice.
So I'm back with John Gagne. I may steal it. No, I'm not going to do it. John, for the Can't Sell This crowd that maybe weren't listening.
Sure.
Let's do a quick little intro for them.
Sure.
You're listening to Can't Sell This, a podcast about creativity, creatives, and their process with your hosts, Hugh Elliott and Stefan Granbart.
I'm John Gagne. I'm an art dealer and a gallerist. I started in New York, and that was a few years ago. Came back in 2020 during the height of the pandemic, and wasn't sure what I was going to do here in Toronto, hometown. but I have this old building that used to be a stable. Mm-hmm. It is now a gallery, and for the last 3 years, I've been running a show a month.
Amazing. Not all through the year.
Like December to April. I can't heat this place, yeah. So it's closed December to April.
Okay. It's great, though. I mean, for those, since this isn't a video podcast, we're actually in your gallery.
Right.
And it when you and I spoke leading up to this, I had said it would be really great if we could sit in your gallery and be surrounded by whatever latest show there was. And talk a little bit about the creative process and also how you have brought maybe not super well-known artists a bit more exposure.
Yeah.
And although we can die from exposure, in this case, it's a good thing.
It's a good thing. This show happens to be Rocky Doby, who is he's an outsider artist. Mm-hmm. So not formally trained. He's a metal worker by trade, but he's been making art for the first 20 years in Toronto, anonymously. He was putting works up, small sculptures, metal books, and so on, all over Kensington Market,
right,
all over downtown Toronto. While I was in New York planning to come back, an artist, a friend of mine, said, if you're going to Toronto, you need to look up Rocky Doby.
Amazing.
And otherwise I would not have known. And I did, and had a fabulous first experience with Rocky in his studio. This is actually now the second solo show with Rocky.
Okay.
So, and it just opened Friday. You were here, which was lovely.
Yeah.
It was packed. And I love this work. I'm really proud of this show.
Mm-hmm. It's striking. At the very least, it's striking.
Oh, yeah.
But it also, there is a level of freedom to the art that I really appreciate.
No, good.
It's not simple, which is probably the best I can do about it. Is the idea that it's quite it's very busy, but it all follows, each one follows its own pattern.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's an interesting artist, and he's exactly the kind of artist I like to work with. Every piece of work here, he says he doesn't, you know, plan ahead. Mm-hmm. He works primarily on copper sheets.
Yeah.
He'll start by painting it black, sometimes with something called asphaltum, which is like a tar.
Right.
Or a machinist ink. And then with engraving tools, he'll start grinding in, hence the copper coming out of black. But anyway, no, so Rocky is, and you know, listen, I found when I was in New York and I first started doing this, I had to trust my own taste. Mm-hmm. And I had to trust my gut in terms of what to show, and in, you know, picking art out of a studio is a bit of a trick. But what I look for is conviction.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Rocky is, he's wall-to-wall conviction.
Right.
He is not thinking about, will it sell? He is thinking about this thing I'm making right now.
Yeah.
And he goes, follows it right out the window. And of course...
Well, sorry to interrupt, but it reminds me of something you'd said earlier that I thought was really interesting was, you know, an artist is, this is going to be a paraphrase, but you were saying as a curator, it was more about pulling yourself out of it and more to understand the artist themselves.
Yeah.
And to say, and the story that you gave was speaking with an artist in their studio, you, instead of pointing randomly at three things and going like, those are the three I want.
Right.
You had a conversation with them,
right,
and got to know the artist better. And that helped guide the selection.
It did, because then you sort of organically arrive at, I mean, I need to know what's important for the artist.
Right.
Because they'll have some things they want to show and some things they don't want to show. And sometimes you both agree, sometimes you don't agree, but it's still interesting, the discussion around why something is in a show or not.
Yeah.
And all that really is based on respect for the work. Because I know you know, none of this is easy. Like for artists, none of it's easy. I think I did a show in New York and I titled it Between You and Oblivion. Because, you know, staring at a canvas, it's like staring at a blank page and trying to write. I mean, most people get paralyzed right there.
Yeah.
Because everything, you know, if everything matters, oh my God, what do I do first?
Yeah.
So that tightrope, that journey they go on with every piece and get to the other side with a piece of work.
Right.
I have a ton of respect for that.
You know, it's interesting. There's, I did a talk in Germany in the spring and one of the things that really struck me was that I said, I'm a technologist who makes art. Mm-hmm. And I had listened to all these other speakers and some of whom I self-identified as artists versus how I think I ended up saying I'm an artist who uses technology to make art. I think that's how I put it on stage because I felt like, oh, I have to justify so much more of what I do because I'm presenting the art as opposed to talking about the process. In a lot of cases, when it comes to creating art, the process is easily as important as the end goal, end result.
Very much.
And so, you know, someone like Rocky, who, when you look at his work, you can see that there has been a process and it has been a length of time that led to this.
Yeah.
When I have talked about the work I have done, I usually say, like, I am as surprised as you are at what came out of it. Mm-hmm. Like, there's been no intention. I have gotten better with what I have created, but there was no intention initially to control that. And so I really like when I come to see art, especially in person. There's nothing that can rival seeing art in person.
No.
This, like these copper plates with that have been painted black, that have been etched, the luster and shine that comes off of the etching, it is an in-person thing. A photo of this would not do it justice.
It doesn't. And it's interesting. My previous show is a wonderful Australian artist named Shane Drinkwater. He does a painting a day.
Okay.
And that process is, to me, reminds me of writers who say you sit down every day and write.
Yeah, yeah.
Because some days, and Shane says this, some days are great and some days are like, oh, it didn't work out.
Right.
But it allows for surprises.
Yeah.
It allows for accidents to happen. And as anyone doing any sort of creative activity, you know how important that is because we all kind of get in our own way.
Yeah.
An artist needs to be very clear, very, very clear. Mm-hmm. And I think this notion of it's my practice and I'm doing it today again, like I did it yesterday.
Right.
That goes a long way to finding work that actually has something sublime about it or something beautiful about it. And what I enjoy is how honest the work is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no trick.
Yeah.
Other than you do it every day.
Yeah, I mentioned this earlier and it sounded extremely mean-spirited, but I had said that the sacrifice attached to making art shouldn't be discounted. And I think that, you know, a lot of cases, there are people who are making art but aren't attached to it. And we see that a lot right now, where you can tell that the person is not attached to the art itself. They don't care about what they produced. They only cared about the production of it.
Yeah.
So I imagine that falls into the domain of a curator and domain of a gallerist to identify someone who is actually taking the art as the process of making art versus their end goal is to get attention, right?
No, it does. I mean, I feel like almost any work that's considered an artwork, whether or not it shows up in a gallery, has a kind of charge in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an idea out there that the artwork itself does half the work, that right. the viewer does the other half.
Right.
So you standing in front of a piece of work and it starts to resonate or not, but let's say it does. Well, now the artwork is alive.
Yeah.
And that happens when, in this case, like we talked about, the work is honest work. In other words, the hand of the artist is visible.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the artist is visible. So I feel that pretty quickly looking at work, especially when you look at a lot of work.
Right.
And different kinds. I mean, I can tell you in New York, when I started doing this, things like sculpture, ceramics, photography even, I wasn't connecting to it.
Right.
Because historically, I was interested in film, painting, you know.
Gotcha.
And it wasn't until I got my socks blown off by a couple of shows where you go, wow, that ceramic artist is on another planet. Like,
yeah.
Look at this stuff.
Yeah.
That you go, okay, this is truly creative work. This is wonderful work. And yeah. you start to appreciate.
The choice of becoming a gallerist and initially being essentially an art tour guide to then becoming a curator to becoming a gallerist.
Yeah.
Like those potentially... In retrospect, that is a 1-2-3 step process, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But when you're in the middle of it, and in the midst of those decisions, when you were doing the tours, did you ever think, "Man, I'd love to put on a show," or do you think that you were sort of saying, "Like, this is what I'm doing right now, and I'm going to just stick with it"?
No. It started to kind of dawn on me because I saw a lot of installations,
right.
a lot of galleries. And the thing that I loved was some of these galleries were pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were small. They were some basement, you know, storefronts. There were, I mean, of course, there are always the big, beautiful white box famous galleries.
Right.
But there were many that were just a little bit like rock and roll, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, wow. And yet it didn't matter so much. The work mattered.
Yeah.
And... So I started to pay attention more and more about where I was, what I was looking at, and mm-hmm. how this got pulled together. And there's always shows where you go, really?
I wouldn't have put that
like,
on
is
the
this
wall.
The show?
Yeah.
Except, you know what? People are showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Art's being sold because it's resonating with someone. So to answer the question, I was starting to think about it after a while that I'd love to try it.
Right.
But it was a daunting idea. And of course... Who's going to give me a shot? How do I make that happen?
Yeah.
And that felt like another mountain to go up, and I wasn't really prepared until, like I mentioned, this woman, Amy Williams at Arts Gowanus said, "Do you want to curate a show?"
Right.
And, you know, the answer was yes, but in my head I'm going, holy Jesus,
what did I just sign up for?
How do I do this? You know, and I was in a mode of, I'm going to trust myself. If I can get one or two steps in, the next few steps will show themselves.
Yeah.
But standing on this side of the river right now, I don't know where those stepping stones are.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I got to get in the river. I got to get in it.
Well, perspective is a hell of a thing. When you started going from being a tour guide, essentially an art tour guide, to curating shows, to then having your first gallery show, because there's a difference between curating a show and having a gallery, right? Would you say or no?
Well, they're different activities, but yeah, one kind of envelops the other.
When you had already created a community for yourself. You had been embraced by a community in New York, at any rate, the art community in New York. To the extent that when you decided when you were asked to curate a show, Were you given a theme or did you decide the theme?
No, it was given to me. I could do whatever I wanted to
okay.
do.
When you, was there a theme to the first show that you ended up with? Or you just put together people you felt would be complimentary?
I brought together the artists that I had visited with or I knew.
Okay.
And I was thinking about a couple of things. I was thinking about the venue. So like I said, it was a bar, a very big bar that was engineered, like designed to show art.
Right.
So
big
as much,
lit walls.
Oh, beautiful yeah. lit walls, sound system for, you know, I brought in a sound artist at one point. So I knew that the venue was impacting my decisions. I couldn't bring in okay. anything too delicate, too fine.
Right.
Because it wouldn't read.
Right.
So it needed to have some drama. It needed to have some scale. Mm-hmm. I wanted some video. I wanted some sound. You know, there were a bunch of factors for me that I thought if I can get it all in, mm-hmm. it'll rock. It'll yeah. be a great show. But the venue in that case was pretty specific.
Okay. How many artists were in that first show?
Oh, at least a dozen. At least a dozen.
Wow.
And some of those artists had one piece.
Okay.
One artist, wonderful artist named Justin Neely, does a number of things, digital art, paint, but also does murals.
Okay.
So I had him working on a giant mural in the sort of the backyard, garden of the bar.
Okay.
So I walked around with the bar owners, for an afternoon, just identifying opportunity.
Okay. In the space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what can I work with? Can I bring in a muralist? Yes. Can I put sound in the bathrooms? So when people go in, it's like, whoa, what's going on?
You yeah.
know? Yes. Again, lots of yes. And so I did. I could then go, okay, I know exactly who I want to bring in. And it all worked like a charm. I had some video going on. Again, I know I've said it, but it was a way to kind of redeem or pay off some of these relationships.
Yeah.
And make it real.
Do you recognize how much of your experience in advertising you leverage to accomplish some of these shows and accomplish some of the stuff you've done?
That's a good question. Yes, in as much as, okay, so I was a creative director. I spent a lot of time with, you know, art directors and writers, mm-hmm. And other people like technologists, around the world of advertising. So all those conversations, and then of course the whole world of pitching ideas
yeah.
to clients, storytelling, and then the marketing and promotion of anything we were advertising. I do bring a lot of that to the work I do for the gallery and that I do as a curator. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that comes up for me is I have to be very aware of, like, there are some things I love right away.
Right.
Like when I see it, I go, God, I love that. I want to show it. I want to own it, all of that.
Yeah.
But I'm careful not to just make every piece a, oh God, I love it.
Right.
There are some things, and there's this notion with design that, like, sort of very good, sort of high design, high level of design is very often kind of shocking.
Right.
Your first thought is, oh God, I don't like that. You know, those colors on that moped, what are they thinking?
Right, right.
Well, in fact, that's a very refined taste
right.
that's been arrived at through, you know, years of expertise on someone's part. So what I'm getting to is that there are some pieces, and I've done it for every show, I'll put in that I know are good pieces, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't necessarily want to own myself.
Right.
But I think somebody would.
Yeah.
Somebody would like this. And so you have to give some room to the decisions or the choices for, you have to open the net out a little
yeah.
so that other people can, you know, for instance, yellow is not my favorite color.
Right.
But I had some pieces in here in the last show with Shane Drinkwater that were like strikingly yellow pieces because I know that some people love it.
Love it, yeah.
And it worked. You yeah. know, people, you know, I sold one. Other people are gravitating toward. It's because, you know what, I'm not everybody.
Yeah.
But I don't want to appeal to everybody, but I want a number of people to be able to go, oh God, I love purple. Look at this purple ceramic.
Yeah.
Yeah, there it is.
Well, removing yourself from the conversation has got, it has to be one of the hardest parts. Like, what, you know, we exist in a state of ego that, you know, we are the main character in our own movie. But the problem is that when you're hanging someone else's art on the wall, you're not the main character. You're the guy that puts the nail up and puts it up. So while you're making choices, it was really, it was gratifying to hear you say, like, I don't like yellow, but I mean, I put yellow on the wall because it's not about me.
Right.
A lot of things that I do, I my response is always, it's not about me. And so, like, these conversations, these interviews, they're not about me. They're about the person I'm talking with.
Right.
And I love the idea that you can release enough of your ego to see, oh, you have taste, but it may not coincide with the taste of others.
Right.
But the artist may have work that will speak to other people.
Definitely.
And that whole conversation aspect of 50% is the art and 50% is the viewer.
Yeah.
That has to be an interesting thing to have embraced.
Oh, I'm telling you, and I'm surprised every show. I'm always surprised, first of all, at the crowd that it draws.
Mm-hmm.
There's always, you know, interesting folks that come around that you wouldn't have anticipated. And the individual pieces, how they attract.
Yeah.
I just listened to, she's one of my favorite artists. She's German. I think it's Charlene von Heil. But she's working in the U.S. An incredible, incredible artist. And I just heard her talk. She was in an interview and the interviewer was saying, well, all these pieces, you know, they're really one piece and it's a kind of a flow. And she went, no, they're distinct pieces.
Yeah.
And what happens is when people walk in, they find their painting.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I do. And I thought, damn, that's good. Like this notion of you find your painting.
Yeah.
You find your artwork. Of course, it speaks to you. It goes right through you.
Yeah.
That's when you're kind of in love with it.
Yeah.
So what I try to do is create a conditions where that can happen,
mm-hmm.
that people can find something that goes right through them.
Well, I mean, like my wife and I have incredibly different tastes when it comes to art. And it's like when we walked through here and looked at the various pieces, there were pieces that I really liked and that Libs kind of just went past, like didn't register to her. But in my mind, I'm like, this is incredible.
Are you seeing this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Are you? And she's like, I really want to go see it. And she mentioned this other piece. And I was like, I mean, I guess. I mean, like, that's not my taste.
Yep.
But that is when your business is selling art, like when we distill it down to the very base
of
nature
course.
Of it, the business is selling art. It you have to have the trust of the artist to give justice to their work. I really loved the idea that woman said they're all distinct pieces.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you make a triptych and it could be put together. Those are distinct pieces. And I think that's when you look around here, especially, you can tell that they're all distinct pieces. This corner here with the metal work and that
sword.
Base plate, those prints are all based off of what's there.
Yep.
And I think that connection may not instantly be seen because someone might just buy that one print.
Well, that's exactly what happened opening night. That piece, which is called Chandelier.
Okay.
You know, that's $4,000. It was a couple. They came in and just said, we want that.
Right.
And it's like, okay. You know, like there was no sell. There was no discussion. There was no unpacking. What is it made of? What is it?
Yeah.
We want that.
Yeah.
So that happens. People find their painting. They find their artwork, you know?
I don't know about you, but I grew up in a space where art wasn't prominent. It wasn't important. It was more family photos and things like that. Since then, you know, my wife's parents were, her father was a antiques dealer.
Oh, yeah.
And so they had art all over
everywhere.
It was incredible. Portraits and architecture work and just stuff it blew my mind to walk through their house. And so it became something for me where we would put art up and we started to support our friends and say like, oh, you've got a print or whatever, let's put that up. But what I've started to do, and when you talk about something like this, where it becomes more of a permanent piece in your house, right? Like, I'm going to put that up. That's going to stay forever.
Yeah.
When you deal with slightly less expensive work, you rotate in and out.
Oh, sure.
Right? So I pull stuff off and put stuff on, and sure, it works for us.
Well, I think that's fun. And I think it adds all kinds of warmth and interest to a home.
Yeah.
And I love the fact, like, our home is filled with art and
yeah,
books, you know. And I love the fact that my kids are growing up around it.
Oh, yeah.
And I make a point of, you know, when we're talking about something, calling out the materials. Material for me, materiality is a wonderful place to get involved, mm-hmm, in terms of what artists are doing with materials. So I like pointing that out. And you hope it sinks in, mm-hmm, with the kids. I trust that it is. But I mean, I grew up kind of, I think, like you, like, there wasn't a lot of art in their house, and
right,
whatever there was just generic stuff.
Yeah.
But once you start going into other people's homes and seeing what it can do.
Yeah.
And again, it doesn't have to be important pieces. It's just important to them.
Yeah.
It's like, man, that is very cool.
It's very cool.
Right.
And I think that, you know, I remember having lots of conversations with my kids, and part of it is that I was trained as an illustrator and then became a technologist sort of accidentally. And Libs trained as she went to OCAD for something, and it was like art-based, but she stumbled into quilting. But she's shown such an affinity for the art of what she does, the design work that she does, that it's worked great for her. And I think of that as a stepping stone for our kids. And we talked a lot, you know, over the course of years, I've always said to my kids that we need to discuss the idea of consumption versus creation. I think it's okay if you want to watch videos, and I think it's okay if you want to think a YouTuber is important or a gamer is important.
Yeah.
But they're making, right? Like, they're playing and making.
That's right.
And what you need to understand is that it's more important to create than it is to consume.
That's right.
And when you as a gallerist are like a purveyor of creation, I think, yeah, it's just it's got to be gratifying.
Oh,
right.
It's very gratifying. And of course you keep, I say learning, but you keep experiencing new things.
Mm-hmm.
The next show, which is going to open, I think November 10, is a group show, interesting Toronto artists, who are all involved in some way with publishing. So
okay,
while they paint, and the focus is really narrative painting, narrative artwork.
Okay.
So very sort of dramatic, you know, pieces.
Right.
They also produce zines, books, magazines, comics.
Nice.
And that for me is also, it's not peripheral, but it's not exactly something, like, you're not going to put the book on a wall.
Right.
But these are things that were made specifically to share work. And that's part of their practice. And I'm looking forward to it. One of the things that'll happen is I'm going to have a poet here.
Okay.
Larry Sawyer, who opening night will do a spoken word performance.
Oh, amazing.
First time in the gallery.
Yeah.
I've done them before in New York, but this is like, you know what? I'm happy to do it here. His partner is a video artist. So again, I'm trying to open up the palette of what we can do here in the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
I know that many, many things have been done forever, everywhere.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm not reinventing that, but I'm happy to be doing it here.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, you had said like the impact of, and so this will be a harken back to the dismissed episode, but you know, you talked about the impact that you may not have been aware in the moment that that losing your job had on your kids.
Yeah.
And the emotional impact it had on you.
Yeah.
Are you kind of in a better mood all the time when you walk from that door
God,
to
yes,
that door?
Yeah, for sure.
Just seeing what you are no longer being,
oh my God,
beholden to?
Yeah. I mean, it's been, I mean, transformational is too small a word. I spent 20 years in advertising kind of dreading every morning.
Yeah.
Dreading it.
Yeah.
Because you are going into a gauntlet every day.
Yeah. Proving yourself constantly.
Oh, and of course it's wholly subjective business. So all around you are people going, no.
Yeah.
And, or no, is that what you're going to show? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Judge, 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 judge.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is, it, again, I've said it, it's a gift. I mean, I realized when we got back from New York and I was starting to plan this gallery, I was waking up earlier and earlier every day.
Right.
And I couldn't wait to get going.
Yeah.
It's like, I want to jump on this. I want to jump on that. I'm meeting some people. I've got studio visits. You know, you lighten up, you open up.
Yeah.
I know it's a whole different experience. I'm very grateful for.
Well, I joke with Libs, and I've said this plenty of times if you listen to any other episodes, but it's always like the old adage that do what you love, you never work a day in your life. And I counter that you do what you love, you'll work all the time, but you like doing it. And that's the difference.
Well, there's the Joseph Campbell thing about follow your bliss.
Okay.
So I did. I followed my bliss. And, you know, we've come to a very, very happy place.
Well, you know, I think a lot of times when you come back from, when you came back from New York and you said, well, I'm going to fix this stable into a gallery and I'm going to put on shows. Like, I'm sure that was not a decision made lightly, but at the same time, you recognized your own need to do the thing you were doing and that you so enjoyed in New York.
Well, definitely. I also, like I said, what I was paying attention to in New York was how almost any venue can be a gallery of some kind.
Right.
That in fact, the most interesting places weren't the formal gallery with the perfect walls and perfect everything.
Yeah.
And it adds, it resonates, right? It adds a kind of halo to the work, the venue.
Yeah.
So I believed in it right away. Like when it's weird that when I came back from New York, I wasn't thinking, oh, God damn, I've got that great building in the back.
Yeah.
I didn't have a clue until I got back here. And then it was like an epiphany that, cause I knew I wasn't going to go back into advertising. So if I'm going to do it, how do I do it? And then the realization of I've got the means here with the building.
Yeah.
The interesting thing was, again, it was a filthy old thing, the building. And it was a whole summer of, you know, flushing it out, power washing walls, and of course, like any sort of renovation, like in the middle of it, it was a war zone.
Oh yeah.
Like I thought, oh my God, like, will this turn out? But then, you know, you get paint on the walls, you get lights up, and I had help, you know, some good friends who were, skilled in particular areas. A guy named Jim Jeffs helped me with the woodwork. Marcus helped me with the cement work and the electrical. Like, people helped.
Right.
But once it got like over the hump and I could see it finishing, it was like, man. And then the other surprise for me, honestly, is that whatever I put on the walls or in the building has popped really well.
Yeah.
The walls are very kind of forgiving. You know, it's rough cut lumber, but paintings, sculptures, ceramics, like I said, photographs, everything works really well. And that was a little unexpected. I wasn't sure how that would go, but I've been very pleasantly surprised.
Has it been, this is going to sound really weird, but has it been sort of an uphill battle leaving New York where you've done all the legwork and you've created that life for yourself there to come to Toronto? Did it feel like a reset in terms of the art world? Like you had to re-engage world here?
Yes. Well, I mean, first of all, I wasn't wholly engaged with the art world here at all.
Right.
Right? I was focused on other things when we were here. And again, now it's like 30-some years living in Toronto.
Yeah. But you said like you were talking to an artist in New York who said you need to look at Rocky Dobie.
Absolutely.
I almost said Ricky Bobby.
That's my next show.
Talladega Nights.
No, it was a reset on all kinds of levels. I mean, one, for us to come back to Toronto, we were very lucky. You know, we kept our home while we were gone. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, oh my God, we have a beautiful home here in a you know, wonderful neighborhood. Like, to some degree, why did we leave?
Yeah.
And I'll say this because Joanne and I, we talk about it, it's like, oh, if somebody said right now, pick up everything and move to New York, I wouldn't go.
No.
At the time, it was the right thing. But now it's like, I'm very, very grateful. Loved New York, what we did there, but very happy to be in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Good for the family. You know, my kids are now in high school.
Right.
We didn't want to go through that in New York. It's a real, you know, arduous process. So it was the right thing. So a reset, yes. And then the first thing I did, I wondered how the community would accept a gallery. frankly, in a lane way, yeah. in a coach house. So my first move was to reach out to the neighborhood, and because I know there were some artists in the neighborhood.
Okay.
Turns out there's lots.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the first, Leslieville is kind of nuts for you.
So the first show I had, I think it was called A Gathering, and I had 10 artists who were all in the neighborhood.
Okay.
And I still work with them all.
Yeah.
It was an eye-opener for me, how beautiful the work was. Again, how wonderful the artists are. But the neighborhood was wonderful. Like, everyone was supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Sold a bunch, a lot of good feedback. And then show over show, more and more people are coming from all over Toronto now,
right.
which is nice. But there's still that kind of core that come back yeah. over and over again. And people walk up the laneway, even, the other day, just like completely surprised. Oh my God, it's a gallery.
Right.
Yes, it is. Come on in. Let me tell you about let me tell you about whatever. So reset on many levels to answer yeah. the question for sure.
To answer your question.
It's a long way around.
I've always said it.
Trust me.
If you say long story short, then it's too late. but I think that it's fantastic. When really fundamental change happens in your life, when you're in the middle of it, you don't recognize opportunity as well as you should, right. as you could.
Right.
And because you're so focused on the change, you're not focused on
yeah.
anything else. I think that, and not to diminish the emotional impact of job loss and all of that, but I think that you needed to have something so fundamental happen for you to recognize, I need to do something else.
Oh yeah.
I've said you must be gratified with it, but I mean, there is a certain level of trust that the artist must have for a gallerist to succeed.
Oh no, definitely. And again, I think some of that comes from I'm always now meeting new artists. They'll contact me sometimes out of the
okay.
blue. But like that opening we had on Friday night, there were a few artists that come around because Rocky is a much beloved artist
mm-hmm.
That were talking to me. And of course, they want to show work. They want to have a place to show work. And I get that. And
yeah.
I respect that. But yes, there has to be, of course, trust. There has to be interest. You know, we were talking about Instagram earlier, how sometimes, you love it, you hate it. Well, one thing it does do is, people will see the crowd at an opening
mm-hmm.
and for sure go, I'd love to have a crowd like that, or I'd love to be in a crowd like that.
Yeah.
So it does attract other folks. The other thing that happens a lot, I think just because, of our ages now, there are people in the neighborhood whose parents were artists, in some case, well-known artists.
Right.
But now the children, my neighbors, have the art.
Right.
Basement's full. So I get a lot of that too. Like, can you come over and look?
Right.
My father was, my mother was, whatever. So I'm getting those invitations now. And the truth is I'm looking for a second space. So those winter months when I can't show here.
Right.
I don't want to stop having shows.
No, for sure.
And the fact is I have more opportunities now with more artists to show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking for a second space in the East End here where over the winter months I can put on other
right.
shows. That takes some pressure off having only so many months
yeah.
to show work.
Well, and also having a year-round space in addition to this, that gives you a more specialized opportunity,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
Where you can have longer shows.
Yep.
You could have a wider variety.
That's the big thing is there's so much good work
mm-hmm.
out there. That I'd love to be able to vent it. In other words, have a venue or a stage that we can share it and hopefully place some of that. Listen, I have shows, I'm hoping this show does well. We started off well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a month, we'll see. Previous show, I probably sold a third of the works.
Right.
That's a good show.
Yeah.
But I've had shows where I'll sell one piece, maybe two. And
yeah.
it's like, I love everything on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't regret a thing. I sure wish more would have found a home.
Right.
Some shows, they don't pull as
mm-hmm.
hard. And that's, I guess, part of the gig. But I love having people come through, and I love being able to literally talk about the work, share the work. There's always surprises and individual pieces that I know, as someone who loves art, I love to learn about. Mm-hmm. I love it when someone says to me, by the way, the artist wrote a poem in the piece. It's right here. You can see it. It's like, oh my God, you know, it's like, that's, I feel like I'm inside the work now.
Right.
I'm closer to the artist. I'm certainly closer to the gallerist who's taken the time. So the whole, not process, but the whole experience of having a venue and showing work just keeps being surprising to me and gratifying.
Yeah.
You know, in ways that, you know, it's like, maybe if I was smarter, I would know that was going to happen. But
right.
I'm appreciative that it is happening. And I'm at a point now, you know, it's still only been a handful of years.
Yeah.
But I'm starting to understand a little bit how to culture that a little bit, how to nourish it a little bit.
There's a certain level of reconciliation between the idea of being there purely for the art and being there for the business of the art.
Yeah.
And recognizing those two things as not being distinguished between the other. So you're selling the work that people want to buy.
Yep.
When you're dealing with an artist, because at the end of the day, no matter how uncompromising an artist might be, they want to sell their work.
Sure.
There's not a lot of artists who sit there with a basement full of work going, I'd never want anybody to touch this or see it.
Yep.
So have you ever had to drag an artist into being interested in the business of being an artist, or in the process of the discussion,
a little bit.
Do you sort of like get them to understand that the point of it is to make a couple of bucks?
A little bit. I mean, some of that I think happens because some artists will be a little shy or reticent about the business of it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not about reticence. It's about, I almost want to say politics. I've worked with some artists in New York, and even Rocky to a degree here, who are not political first, not primarily political, but the politics matters.
Right.
So, you know, the reason Rocky makes work to some degree, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, is, you know, he is active in a number of movements.
Okay.
Some of that has to do with prison reform, drug rehab, gentrification, globalization. You know,
sure.
Rocky has a history of making posters, actually, that became quite famous, that showed up in Berlin, showed up in Athens,
right,
around anarchists.
Right.
Well, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that he's throwing punches and that it's landing.
Yeah.
Now, somebody comes in, and I had this with the last show with Rocky, bought a very radical piece of work right off the walls and said, that's going right over our bed, on the wall, right over the bed.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, wow, that bedroom must be smoking. Because... because this work has a pretty heavy charge,
right?
In terms of the how it resonates. So there are artists who, depending on their motivation, don't want to shill. They don't want to be just, you know, banging this stuff out, and you know it matters to them,
right?
And what I do is, and I mean, I will absolutely, I have to listen and abide. But the reason we're talking is that we have an opportunity to share the work and to place it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and what that does, obviously, is allows me to get to the next show with the next artist and hopefully place work.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever kind of keeps it afloat. I mean, I remember talking with a gallerist in New York, very successful, small gallery, but successful, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, I said, well, yeah, but New York, Jesus, like, how do you begin? And he said, well, you know, I have a trust fund. And I talked to my mother about it. And it's like, oh my God. It's like, okay, well, I don't have that kind of, you know, resource. So, you know, I bootstrapped it the way a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
But to the business question, you know, you want to place work. And for all the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Like we talked about art in a home. You know, I'm glad that radical piece of work is over that woman's bed.
For sure.
You know, I'm glad that there were many, many people that bought some smaller pieces from Rocky that you can see here. And when I go to their homes or I go to their offices and I see it, mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, man, it's like a little beacon. So, yes, to answer again the question, there are some artists that will be a little more discerning.
Right.
And their motivations will be a little more complicated.
Sure.
Yeah. But that's what makes them great.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, from, let's say, the pure craft artist that's, you know, absolutely in love with glass. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a beautiful piece of glass, and I'm happy to show it. But if you put a piece of work, or you want to put a piece of work up with some, you know, fairly anarchist, you know, symbols in it, man, I'm ready for that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm ready for the fine aesthetic work, and I'm ready for the hardcore.
Yeah.
You know?
We talked about the art year of making that I did, and the point of it was, somebody was like, oh, you should sell. And what I did was I listed every piece, but I did it where I gave over half of what I made to organizations.
Oh, that's good.
So I never made money off of it. And it was so important to me to do that, because I felt that it justified my use of the pride colors. Or,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think an ally shouldn't profit. And so, like, I had this idea that I was never going to profit for that entire year, and which was fine. It would, like I said, like, I have this delicate balance.
I thought it was beautiful work.
I appreciate that. But what happened is that I applied to be part of the Toronto East General Hospital had a new wing, and they had an art call for artists. Yeah. So I had applied, and this woman who was part of the, what is it called? Steering committee or whatever it's called. Yeah. She contacted me, and she goes, so I think, and this was before they made the decisions. She goes, I think your piece is going to be selected. And I say that with, like, near certainty, but I also want to buy it. Cause she was a, interior designer. She says, I want to buy it for a client. So what was really funny is that I had given I'd given the hospital a massive discount.
Sure.
She had that number and went, I want that number. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Which she's bought, like, three different, like, the same photo she's bought three times for different clients, all with that one number. Yeah. And I keep kind of saying, like, all right, well, I've done the donation aspect of it. This is now I need to make money. And you're making a huge sum off of the work. So it is, I've never been a good artist in terms of, like, trying to make money.
It's not easy. And I'll just tell you one thing. When it happens again, because it might happen again with you, there's nothing wrong with saying to that woman, listen,
that was not the number.
That number is for an institution, for a cause.
Yeah.
You know, these actually sell for X.
Yeah. I just want to see where it is. I think that'd be amazing.
Oh, no, I'm with you. I can tell you, though, the pricing in New York, same thing. A lot of artists, same as in Toronto, a lot of artists don't know or don't have a good feel for, like, what do we charge? Because it's a tricky thing.
The humility of an artist is probably the biggest hindrance for them to make money, right?
It's like, hard.
Because they would say, well, I made five. I will charge $100. And you're like, no, idiot. That's $1,000. You know what I mean?
Right.
And no matter whether or not you're making a percentage
series.
Or a commission or whatever.
Yes.
Like, the drive to challenge an artist to accept the value of their art must be a difficult one.
It's not that it's difficult, but it's frequent. Like, it comes up a lot. And part of that comes from, I think anyone sometimes, unless you get used to it and you sort of train yourself a little bit, it's hard to ask.
Mm.
It's money.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. And again, an artist or any sort of creator will also know what went into it. Sometimes it's very quick.
You
make something and it's like, what, really? $1,500?
Right.
And sometimes it's labor intensive.
Yeah.
It's like, you mean it's only $1,500?
Yeah.
So it's a tricky thing. What I think about a lot is really what the market will bear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to max out what the market will bear, but, and there's some famous stories of artists who were overpriced early and then lost all the air goes out of the balloon
right.
by the second show.
Yeah.
It's like, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
So one thing that I think good gallerists do and art dealers do is kind of manage that so that it's reasonable, or at least it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're buying work this year versus 5 years from now, well, then, you know, in theory, I can tell you Rocky's work year over year just gets more amazing, more involved. So yeah, it
yeah.
costs more now than it did in 2021.
For sure.
But it needs to be, I think, a kind of a rational progression.
The business of art is an entirely different conversation.
Oh, and it's famously opaque, you know. Like,
but do you feel like I've missed something? Would you like to, is there something unsolicited you'd like to talk about real quick? Like as sort of like a footnote to the conversation?
You know what? The only thing, I think we kind of brushed up against it, but I want to tell you about, I'll just tell you a quick story. It'll be very quick, but it helped me a lot about what happened. I brought a group into a New York gallery.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So it's called Bridget Donahue. It's the gallery's named after Bridget Donahue, who's the dealer. It's a great, great gallery. It was on the Bowery. It might still be there on the Bowery. I brought a group in. These were a group of women who were buyers, right? So they have means, they have appetite, they're looking to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist was, and she's one of my favorite artists, but sometimes I screw up her name, but it's Susan Cianciolo.
Okay.
She came out of the fashion business, fashion industry in the 70s and 80s in New York, but realized that while she was making clothes and runway events, that in fact she was crossing over uh-huh. into more of an art event, an art world
right.
event. And she embraced it, and the art world embraced her. But she is a very unconventional artist. And so here's what we saw when we go up into the show. And I'd seen the show and I knew what it was. And I thought, these women are going to love it. And I'll tell you right now, it tanked.
The oh, women really?
Didn't love
oh,
it.
Wow.
But the show was, when you walked into the gallery, there were a number of what looked like almost small houses. But you could walk in them. But mm-hmm. So imagine it's a large gallery with these wooden frame structures, very basic. So you could see right through them, but you could walk in the doorway, for instance,
right.
or walk through a wall. And there were boxes of things, like little cardboard boxes that were filled with sometimes fabrics, papers, marbles, things. And part of the show was a kind of a performance that when you walked into this little house, if you will, and sat down and started rummaging through stuff, they would bring you tea.
Okay.
So I bring these women up. And we sit down, and of course they're kind of looking around like, well, where's the art? And it's like, well, we're in it.
Okay.
This is the art. The art is Susan Cianciolo saying, pay attention to these other pieces, fabric pieces. And she works a lot with groups. So she might have children sometimes drawing and coloring.
Right.
Sometimes other women will be making things. Not in any way what we expect
right.
as an artwork, quote unquote. But it was lovely. And they were boxes everywhere. And anything you picked up was kind of like, you know what? It's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how to begin to like imagine selling that. But Bridget Donahue, you know, she knows what she's doing.
Right.
And then I said, now watch, because we're going to have tea. And they're like, what? And then sure enough, out comes one of the assistants from the gallery with a tray, and we're having tea
right.
in this sort of house with sort of domestic articles all over. And I said, like, isn't this amazing? Like, this
right.
is wonderful. Like, and in my head, I'm going, only in New York, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Only in New York do you get to see this and do this. And it's, you know, Susan Cianciolo. Well, of course, it just tanks.
Yeah.
They can't wait to get out of there.
Yeah.
But I was gracious. And of course, I met Bridget many times. I was gracious with her and we go. But afterwards, I saw a post and it was Susan Cianciolo's post and she was just posting the show. And I said, listen, I brought some people in. And I said, we loved it. You know, this was a really lovely experience. And it was, what struck me was, it's not that everything is meaningful.
Sure.
Everything doesn't have to be important, but everything has meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it was handmade, hand-stitched, hand-put together. And she just wrote back, you know, thank you.
Right.
Because I got it.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting experience on, again, when we talk about the edges and the peripheral of what constitutes, again, quote unquote, artwork, it's a very wide perimeter.
Yeah.
And it goes into many, many, many places. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the kind of formative experiences for me, which was we were actually privileged to be in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got it. Some of those others didn't get it. But it didn't dampen the experience for me. In fact, it heightened it.
Right.
That's the last thing I'll just say.
Well, you know, what is the beauty is in the eye of the beholder kind of thing. I think experience is experienced differently by everyone.
Everybody.
And it's the same thing as when you look at like a overnight art show like Nuit Blanche, where
Wonderful.
If you go from one thing to another, you might not like that, but you'll love this. And so, you know, I think a lot of what we're dealing with when there's so much reality pressing down on us, there is an invaluable aspect to being able to stand in front of art and just consume it and live it.
And sometimes it's the smallest, humblest thing that matters.
Yeah.
You know, and that's always, I think it just kind of raises some consciousness a little bit. It does make you kind of more attuned to your own home life mm-hmm. and your own things and what's important or not important. It's nice to have a little more sensitivity.
Yeah. Well, on that note, John.
Hugh.
This has been so great.
Thank you.
I'm so happy
to have the opportunity.
I really enjoyed myself. I apologize that I wasn't quite on the ball when it came to let's book this, but I'm so glad we made it happen.
We did it.
This is it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of Can't Sell This was produced in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. All creative content in this episode is copyright Hugh Elliott and Stefan Grambart. Questions or comments can be emailed to admin@cantsellthispodcast.com. Music for the podcast is provided by Not Of. Find Not Of at notof.bandcamp.com. Opening and closing voiceover provided by jeffwright.ca. If you enjoyed this episode, a like in whatever platform you use goes a long way to helping the podcast get noticed. Thanks for listening and keep creating.
It was you.